And y'all just keep it locked. I'll be right back next Tuesday, same time, same place.
You look at me like I'm unfamiliar. Acting brand new like you never knew that you liked them thick. I've been carrying this weight in a world beneath these braids, and I'm confused. Would you take the pain that came with all the parts you wanna claim for you? You want my thighs, you want my stride, but not this melanin. You want my hair, but you don't care for this. I'm a black woman. I'm a black woman. Hard breath-fed, sweet tea sipping, Nubian queen with the skin that glistens. I'm a black woman. 16 sitting on a cold floor in the corner after school, recovering from your cover-up when you told me I wasn't right for you. It wasn't hard to believe, 'cause when I watched TV I would never see a leading lady look like me. Familiar package with less pigment, I ain't ignorant, it's just reality.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Thank you. All right. You are listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. I'm your host, Jules Bijal. It's just around 5:06 past past the hour. It's Tuesday, February 13th, a sunny, gorgeous day in Montreal. Nice change from this horrible, gloomy, gray weather we've been having. But today on the show, we've got, a bunch of great clips, interviews on some of the big issues going on right now in Montreal. So this is some of the work I've been doing at the station, covering local news with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. And so those are the clips that we're going to play for you today, stories that matter to the community here at CKUT. First on the show, we've got Concordia professor Ted Rutland. He shares how to make sense of the rise in carjacking and new policing priorities in historical terms when the SPVM, the police in Montreal, often get big budget increases, even in the last year, as other public services, including transit, have had to deal with budget cuts. Later on the show, Massimati president Laurent Lafontaine talks about this new special Black History Month edition of Montreal's Afro Queer Film Festival. That's happening this weekend with a premiere on Thursday. We've also got dispatches from today's Association of McGill Professors of Law picket line from new volunteer Gazelle. Gazelle is part of our news collective that we've restarted here at CKUT. So you can always reach out to our volunteer coordinator or our spoken word coordinator at the station if you're interested in producing local news here at the station. So yeah, that's a great way to get involved if you are looking to do a show, but maybe, that seems like too big of a commitment all by yourself. We've got a whole collective that's going out. They're covering demonstrations. They're covering picket lines. They're talking to striking students. They're doing all kinds of community coverage, and it's a great place to learn how to do that work yourself. Finally on the show, we've got a look back at some of the opposition to contentious Housing Bill 31, which could be passed as soon as this week. Remember that that is the bill that would end the right to transfer your lease for all Quebecers. But first, I've got a story on the housing crisis at the local level and how boroughs in Montreal are responding to it. Take a listen. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. I'm Jules Bujal. High rents, low vacancy rates, and more forced evictions. This is the new normal for renters in what's been called the biggest housing crisis Quebec has ever seen. The province's housing bill, the contentious Bill 31, has been widely opposed by renters and housing committees. But local governments are under pressure now to take action as well. On Monday night, the mayor of Mercier-Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, or MHM, submitted a notice of a motion to ban all apartment fusions in the borough.
Avis de motion est donné par M. Lesarblay, qui sera présenté à une séance subséquente du conseil d'arrondissement, le règlement modifiant le règlement d'urbanisme de l'arrondissement Mercier-Hochelaga-Maisonneuve afin d'interdire la fusion de logements sur l'ensemble de son territoire.
The motion builds on a 2020 rule that banned subdivisions, with some exceptions. It will be studied at the borough's Comité Consultatif d'Urbanisme this Tuesday the 13th. But the problem, according to housing organizers, is that landlords keep finding loopholes to exploit. That's the case in Park Extension, says Amy Darish.
So in 2020, they put some restrictions around certain kind of permits for subdivisions and for fusions in buildings larger than six units. The problem is it doesn't restrict enlargements altogether, and that's the loophole that landlords are now exploiting.
Darish is a member of the Comité d'Action de Parc Extension. The group held a rally outside last Tuesday's Villeray-Saint-Michel Park Extension Borough Council meeting in support of a group of tenants being evicted over a supposed enlargement. They called on elected officials to ban permits for the enlargement, which they believe is fraudulent, as well as any permit that would lead to eviction. During the question and answer period, Bromaire Laurence Lévin-Lalonde told a member of the group that, although housing is a priority, the borough lacked the legal means to refuse permits when the criteria are met.
Émettre un permis à quelqu'un qui en fait du mal la demande, c'est exigé par la loi, là. Si on n'émet pas de permis à quelqu'un qui nous fait une demande qui répond à nos critères, on va à l'encontre de notre rôle. On peut pas décider qu'on retient un permis parce que on a peur qu'il y ait une éviction. C'est pas quelque chose qu'on peut faire. On n'a pas d'outils concrets ou législatifs ou réglementaires qui nous permettent de retenir un permis.
The borough may currently lack the tools to refuse a permit just because they're afraid an eviction will take place. But that's exactly what housing committees are asking them to do, to come up with some solution to keep people in their homes during a housing crisis. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. All right, we are back live in studio. You're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM. Next on the show, we've got Concordia University Professor Ted Rutland to talk about new police hires, declining gun violence, and the carjacking wave we've been hearing so much about. His research and activism focuses on the racial politics of urban planning and policing in Canadian cities, and he's often the one to put a critical lens on some of the numbers and headlines we're seeing from the SPVM. All right, Dr. Ted Rutland, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Let's just dive right into it. So earlier today, mm-hmm. we saw the SPVM make a big announcement. They say hiring is up, crime, especially gun violence, is down, but other types of crime, mainly carjacking, is skyrocketing. These are kind of the big bullet points that I feel are coming out of that announcement. What have you sort of been thinking about this in the hours since that event happened?
So they held a press conference to kind of talk about their achievements in 2023 and announce their strategic orientations for 2024. And this isn't something that the SPVM has usually done. So this seems to be a kind of public relations strategy introduced by Fadi Daguerre, the new police chief, and his executive. And it does what he wants it to do, which is it gets positive stories about the police into the media. He's done a ton of media interviews since becoming the police director. And so they basically get to decide what the story is, and the journalists, for the most part, will just write it down. So what I thought was interesting in the press conference were a couple of things. One is they talked about gun violence. And so gun violence was down in 2023. It was down by 36%. And so they want to claim that this is a big achievement for them. And, of course, it is good news. There's no questioning that. But there is a lot to question within that. I guess the first thing is that gun violence increased in 2020 in Montreal. As it did everywhere in North America, for reasons that are pretty obvious, the social disruptions of the pandemic, which meant that all kinds of organizations and institutions that normally do violence prevention work, you know, kind of as a matter of course, weren't functioning well. Like schools are violence prevention institutions, even though that's not how they conceive of their work. You have youth hanging out with other kind of adult mentors, whether it be a teacher, like a theater director, soccer coach. This is all really good. Schools weren't functioning. Community organizations weren't functioning, and people were suffering from various kinds of mental health problems. So violence went up here as it did everywhere else. The police for 3 years were telling us that we needed to hire way more police officers in order to get violence under control. Gun violence came down despite them not hiring all these extra police officers. And now they want to take credit for it and tell us it's because of the good work that they've been doing. But gun violence went down everywhere in 2023 for the same reasons that it went up before, that we were coming out of some of the worst parts of the pandemic, some of the social disorder we're recovering from. So it's a little rich for them to say that gun violence was up because they didn't have enough resources. And then when they weren't able to hire as many extra cops as they told us they needed, gun violence comes down and they say, well, it's just because we've been really effective. And then we're on to our next little crisis, which is we need more cops now to fight car theft.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a second. You know, the carjacking epidemic is like, you know, everybody's talking about it. Trudeau is talking about it. The Port of Montreal is a locus. But before we dive into that, I'm just, you know, I'm curious about the community aspect. You mentioned the importance of just like community centers, places where people can go and find some kind of social solidarity, some kind of resources as like this big, you know, this big factor in making sure that there isn't this rise in gun violence and crime. The cops say, well, it's us, it's our numbers, it's our presence on our streets, but they also point to community policing as a kind of way that, you know, the Montreal community has partnered with the SPVM and basically caused this decrease in gun violence, not like community centers, but this form of policing that is more engaged with these kind of institutions. I want to hear your take on that and also just like dive into like what exactly community policing means at a very concrete level.
Sure. So Fadi Daguerre, the new police director, he came into the position a little over a year ago. He's sort of established his brand as being the community police person. And he's very much a proponent of it. But you're asking, you know, what community policing is. And so I'll say a bit about what it is and a little bit of its history in Montreal. It long precedes Fadi Daguerre. So community policing can mean very, very many things because it combines two words in the English language, community and police, that are very ill-defined. But basically, community policing comes out of the failures of post-Second World War policing in the United States and in Canada, as well as Britain and France, where, you know, the 1960s are marked by huge protests against police racism and violence. In the U.S., you know, there's a series of what the media and the police call riots after police killing or harming unarmed Black people in inner cities. I call them riots, too, but in a positive way. I think there's something really inspiring about riots. They're not these irrational kind of nonsensical things that people like to paint them as being. As well, the police are very, very bad at arresting people for serious crimes because if you want to, you know, track down someone who committed a crime, you actually need the community to support you. You need the community to provide you information. And when your entire model is based on being really detached from the community, swooping in and like busting heads when it's time, you're not going to get a lot of community sort of allies in your fight. So police departments across North America started shifting towards community policing model. In the United States, that began in the late 60s and early 70s. In Canada, it started in the 80s. And what it involves is what it sort of sounds like, is that you're going to have more police officers spending time just building relationships with community members. And what they usually mean is community organizations. And what comes with that is just being the police are everywhere. So the police are now, they're umpiring your baseball game. You're playing basketball against them. They're at your community event in the park. They're in your school. They're sitting on neighborhood roundtables, what they call table de concertation. They're everywhere in the community. And they're there as a kind of public relations effort to show you that, like, police are nice people. They're like, we smile. We'll, like, remember your name. And, you know, the police that they put in the positions of going into the community are generally, like, nice people, you know, or at least they're able to present themselves that way. So they're good at this. And then it also is to try to get intelligence from people. And so all that to say that, you know, community policing is not new. It goes back 40 years, and it's implemented primarily to dampen resistance to the police and to spread police, you know, further through the kind of fabric of the community. And so the latest phase of this has occurred, you know, in the last two or three years in Montreal, where the SPVM has worked really closely with the city to strengthen the ties of the police to what they call the community, but they're doing it specifically in the communities that they target, the neighbors, the neighborhoods that they think are the source of gun violence. And so, like, I don't know, I'm a white middle class man. I have not seen the police more in my life in the last 3 years, and I don't expect them to be more in my life. But if you're a young racialized working class person in the northeast of the city, you already saw the police, you know, as an omnipresent force in your life before the civil shift, and now they're kind of everywhere. And one of the sort of telltale signs of this is the police continually talk about community partner. They don't talk about community organizations. So they are, whether they mean to or not, they are casting community groups into two categories, the ones who are our partners and the ones who, like, aren't affiliated with us. And that's a problem, right? It's really, really, really important that some spaces and organizations be independent from the police. I would rather that they all be independent of the police, but at the very least, we need some of them to be independent, because it's politically important to have spaces, like you're saying, of, like, you know, popular education, mobilizing, etc. But also just in a basic sense of, like, if we want to, you know, reduce violence, part of what that involves is having really wise community workers building relationships with people who are kind of involved in worlds that involve a little bit more violence, like people who are criminalized. And, you know, common sense sort of tells us that those kinds of folks aren't going to show up to a community center if it's full of cops. So we really, really need those independent community spaces and organizations. And the SPDM and the city have done everything in their power to eliminate those in the last 3 years, which is really detrimental to fighting violence and creating movements for social and racial justice as well.
Yeah, I mean, even just anecdotally, I lived in Outremont in a very Hasidic Jewish neighborhood during the pandemic, and I can tell you that, you know, what police community links were there did not help relations between the Hasidic community that was trying to find ways to pray together during a pandemic, during a lockdown, and the cops. I saw the cops more than I ever have in my life and probably ever will since. So I can only imagine what it would be like for racialized communities over that same time frame. But sort of pivoting a little bit to the carjacking epidemic, this is somewhere where the SPVM is really asserting its need for more money, asking the city to invest in the organization so that they can then investigate the organized crime aspect of vehicle theft and smuggling, which, you know, according to some data we're seeing, one figure I've seen from Ekitse Association, an organization targeting insurance fraud and crime, thefts in the province of vehicles are up 50% in 2022 compared to 2021. You know, I'm wondering what you make of these numbers. Like, what exactly is happening? Because this really seems to be the new focal point for cops in the city saying, hey, we actually, even though it's a time of contraction and public service spending is on the decline, we really need these resources to help middle-class Montrealers who are just trying to get around, just trying to get to work. What's your take here?
Well, police spending has been the one sort of quote-unquote public service where spending has been shooting through the roof for 20 years. And so the last 3 years have seen the largest budget increases for the police in Montreal history. But, you know, obviously the police are going to want more money. And with gun violence decreasing, they're going to need, you know, another way to tell us that they need more resources. I don't know how long they'll stick with the car theft story, but they're going with that right now, and they are explicitly asking for more money from the province, but they'll probably ask for the city, too, to create a specialized unit focused on car theft. Now, when people start talking about, like, crime numbers, and they say it's up from 2021, I mean, the first question you got to be asking is, like, well, why 2021? Why just 2 years? What happens if we went back to 2020? What happens if you looked at a larger stretch of time? And what you find is that car thefts in 2019 were at their lowest level since data was gathered on this. It was very low, this very steep decline since the early 2000s. And it did increase significantly from 2020 till the end of 2023, but we're still around the average for the last 20 years. So we've seen a spike in the last 2 or 3 years, but it's still at a very low level. You know, car theft isn't nice. I don't have a car, but if I had one, I wouldn't want it to be stolen. Like, that's a real thing. We should want it to, you know, we should, I guess, want there to be fewer car thefts, but we do need to see it in a historical perspective. Then the other thing is, well, what can we do about it? And also, who is organizing around making car theft this big story? So some of the people who are obviously organizing and making this a big story are police departments who want more resources. Pierre Poilievre at the federal level, who just loves a sort of a panic around crime to blame on Trudeau, and I'm not at all defending Trudeau. Poilievre played this very well because there was a conference organized for February 8th in Ottawa that was going to bring together police departments across the country, as well as insurance agencies, border police, et cetera, to talk about car theft. He's smart enough to know that that's going to be a day where the Liberals announce some new measures to combat car theft, and he just announced his a week ahead of time and made the Liberals look like they didn't care or weren't planning to do anything. So people are organizing around it because you can try to build public concern about it. The thing that's really difficult for them is that the people who are trying to make a big deal out of it is it's not something that people care that much about. Like people get very upset about violence. Car theft, you know, it's not great, but it's usually not a violent crime. So they're doing a bunch of things to try to make this something that we all care about. So first is they say, well, insurance rates have gone up a lot. Insurance rates went up, they say, $100 a month in the last year. But of course, insurance rates went up for a bunch of reasons, not just car theft. The cost of cars has gone up. The cost of auto parts and labor has gone up. So we don't actually know how much of that insurance increase is actually due to car theft. Secondly, they keep trying to tell us that car theft, what seems like almost like a victimless crime, is actually part of this really dangerous thing. So they'll say things like, car theft provides revenue for organized crime. But that's sort of like saying that like selling hamburgers makes money for McDonald's. Like, they're a restaurant. They sell things. The things that they sell give them money. Like, organized crime are organizations involved in crime. So if one of their business projects is car theft, yeah, it brings in money for the organization. And then, of course, when they start talking about street gang involvement and street gangs, there are street gangs in all kinds of communities, but in Toronto and Montreal, you say street gang, it's a way of saying scary black youth. And so the Montreal media in particular has been saying, oh, well, like lots of street gangs are getting into car theft in order to buy guns. And a sex worker friend of mine put this very well. She's like, that's like saying women get into sex work to buy lingerie. Like, they're getting the cart before the horse or whatever. Like, people buy guns because they're involved in something that makes a gun a useful thing to have, like car theft or drug dealing. They don't sell drugs or steal cars in order to buy guns. So they're trying to make this into something that we should really be fearful about. So that we'll give them more resources. And what's really scary, of course, is that Poilievre is really on a campaign to increase mandatory minimum sentences for anything involving car theft, to deny people bail if they're charged with car theft. It's like, you know, 2/3 of people in provincial prisons right now are there awaiting trial, meaning they haven't been convicted of anything. This should be a national crisis. And we're talking about denying people bail so we can stick them in a provincial prison before they'd even be convicted of a car theft. And it's a car theft. This isn't like, you know, I can see the argument for like someone who killed a bunch of people, like that, okay, you don't really want that guy on the street. I can see the rationality of the argument. But for car theft, are you kidding me? Again, it's like not nice to have your car stolen, but like we can't just be like throwing people in prison without a, you know, a due process because we have some numbers that say the car theft has increased.
Yeah. So then what I'm hearing from you is that this is this new PR effort from the SPVM in Montreal to, you know, basically say, we're doing such a good job, give us more funding and we can do a better job on this big political issue, but it's both a bit disingenuous with how they're spinning the data and the consequences of, you know, investing more in policing and prisons, but especially now, like as we're divesting from other social services and like the social fabric, is just a big bad idea. And it's one that, from what you're saying, seems to be not getting the kind of public challenge that you'd like to see it have.
Yeah, we're not getting a lot of public challenge on that. And so, you know, unfortunately, we're like in our political system right now, we tend to have a right-wing party and then a liberal party, whether we're talking about the municipal level in Montreal or the federal level. And the right likes to go tough on crime, and the liberals just mostly mimic their policies. And it's been that way for a while, so we're not doing well on this politically. And then the thing is like every little panic, whether it's about gun violence, whether it's about car theft, it results in more resources for the police and stricter punishment for people who are accused or convicted of these crimes. And then when the wave descends, they keep the resources and they keep the stricter penalties. So to me, this is like how the police and prison systems have grown massively in the last 40 years in Canada and the United States. It's like, it's not like people are making abstract budget calculations or making abstract decisions about how long people should go to prison for a given crime. It's like the series of waves of little panics where resources are thrown for a particular reason, stricter punishments are decided upon for a particular reason, and then we move on. And when those problems go away, they keep resources, they keep the stricter punishments, and now we increase the resources and punishments for another reason.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely something that folks will have to keep in mind, because this issue is, you know, it's not one that I think is going to leave the public discourse and leave the conversation anytime soon. But Dr. Ted Rutland, thank you so much for joining us on CKUT to sort through all of that.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. All right, that was Concordia's Dr. Ted Rutland on the police press conference that happened earlier today. This month is Black History Month, and that means that February has been packed with community events celebrating the Afro-Montreal community. We've got another one coming up this weekend, a special Black History Month edition of the Massimati Festival, which celebrates Afro-LGBTQ+ arts and film. Earlier today, I spoke with their president, Laurent Lafontaine, about this week's mini-festival and why championing the Afro-queer community is more important than ever. Take a listen. So thanks so much for chatting with me. Can I just get you to introduce yourself?
Yes, so my name is Laurent Lafontaine. I am the president of Massimati Foundation.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that foundation and the festival as well?
Massimati Foundation is an organization that promotes and supports Black Afro-queer artists and in Montreal. And for the Black History Month, we are having a special edition with some screening, discussions, and with a concert actually also.
Is this the first special edition of the festival? I know that you guys usually do something sort of late summer, early fall.
Actually, the festival has, we at the beginning, from 2009 and 2022, we always had the festival in February.
Oh.
So, and it's last year to 2023, we had the festival in fall, and now we're going to keep having the festival in fall. And this time for that, we have, it's like a small edition. It's like, we say it's a special edition for the Black History Month, where we're having just a weekend, actually 4 days, from Thursday to Sunday. We have 4-day events, so it's a short event. Just to have a presence in the Black History Month, because we want the queer communities to be acknowledged in that month also.
Yeah, so could you tell me a little bit more about what's in store at this special edition of the festival? Yeah.
The event will be from February 15 to February 18. And so the opening is Thursday. And this is our big event because we are having a special guest, actually. It is a conductor, the first Afro-queer conductor. His name is Daniel Bartolome Poiser. And he's coming, and we're going to screen on Thursday 15 a documentary about him. And then he will be there to have a discussion with the public. And people will have the opportunity to see him play, actually, to see him conduct an orchestra on Saturday, February 17th.
Yeah, it's funny because the film follows his role conducting in Thorgy and the Thorchestra, which is, yes. You know, for those of you listening who don't know, Thorgy is this white New York drag queen who became, I guess, famous from the TV show RuPaul's Drag Race. So you think of that and, you know, you have a very specific image of what that performance is and who's involved. And then it seems like this film says, well, actually, you know, there's all these other folks involved in the production, including this Afro-Canadian queer conductor. Can you tell me more about why that was a story that you wanted to share for the festival?
We wanted to share this movie for the festival because actually it is a film because we know classical music is very classic, I mean, straight and very conservative, actually. It is a conservative place. And for us, we wanted this movie break that barrier because it brings an Afro-queer musician and also a drag queen. So it's like opening this place for Afro people, for queer people, and for us it goes with what Massimadi want to promote, is that the Afro-queer people have place in every domain in the community, in the society.
I know that there's other films being screened around the theme of transcendence. What does transcendence signify to you?
Oh, actually, exactly. For us, we have the thematic transcendence, and the transcendence is because it's to uplift the community. You know, because in the last edition, we talked more about healing, trauma, and now we want to go beyond that, actually, and to elevate ourselves spiritually talking also, and to break barriers, to reinvent ourselves. So it's for that we have that thematic, a bit more uplifting, to think differently. And also we have a movie that we go with movie with that thematic. For example, on Friday we have a movie about intersex people. So in a way it's for us to interpret it also as a kind of transcendent, like seeing, to see gender identity beyond the binary male, female, and exactly, and to reinvent our concept and find new concept, new way to define ourselves and to be more coherent with who we are inside.
Yeah, you know, you said that you wanted to change the theme, do something different from last year. The foundation's been around, I believe, since 2009. How have you seen, I don't know, the reception or the community engagement or just even the importance of the festival change in that time frame? What's changed for you guys?
A lot has changed, actually, and in a way that the fact that we're still here is a sign that people are still following the festival and asking for it. And what has changed is that at the beginning we were very little and people were not a lot talking about Afro-queer people. And now the conversation about diversity in art, in cultural place, has started to become a bit mainstream because now the government are talking about it and we have more subvention to bring that diversity in the mainstream. So the thematic we were aborting in 2009, now they become a more governmental issues that people talk about and want to improve also.
I mean, how does that feel from your perspective? Because it's, you know, obviously Massamatti is about art and community engagement and all of these things. And, you know, to have these sort of ideas and these issues that you've been sharing and talking about suddenly become this like larger social and governmental concern. How does that happen?
It's great because it's being taken seriously, and so it's a satisfaction. It's that we are happy about it also. So yes, for us it means that things are moving forward. But I think that we have to still be careful because at the same time we know that people of different diversity are taking their place, whether it's Black community, Afro queer community, trans people. Every people now are aware and want that their right be taken in consideration. But at the same time, we know that people from white wings, also conservative people, are also in their way want to stop also those movements. So we still have to be careful, and we still have to be engaged so that our rights are not lost, because yes, it's not a complete win, because things can still switch.
Yeah, it absolutely seems like, you know, this is becoming so much more accepted in the mainstream, and then there's this backlash, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of backlash. We can see if we see what's happening, or example in USA with Trump, thing like that. So those things also can influence us. We have at a last fall in Quebec, we have a lot of discussion about drag queen, because people were against the fact that a drag queen Barbada was telling fairy tales to kids, and people associate that with promotions of sexuality and things like that, and there were a backlash. So it's not completely a win-win, but these subjects are making the front line. So
yeah, I hadn't heard about Barbada, that there was. So you're saying that, you know, the kind of U.S. culture war over drag queen story time, this is now in Quebec, and not just with any like performer. It's somebody who, when Madonna was on tour, she brought Barbada like on stage with her to judge the ball. Yes. This is like a huge name in the scene, and so you're saying that she's being targeted by this kind of hate as well.
Yes, but that's what I'm saying. So when those subjects become famous, so people become more target also.
Yeah.
But it's not that I say that things are moving forward, but we still have to be careful also.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess transcendence is also like, you know, persisting and rising above all that. In that vein, I also want to talk about, I know that last fall you guys started a mentorship program for young people. Yeah, exactly. Could you tell me a bit more about that as well?
Hey, actually, this program is going very well, and we're going to have a final event in March. We want, because the first mentor was about screenwriting. It's in the way to have more product from Montreal, actually. Yeah. Because we have, for example, Massamatti, during our festival, we present a lot of movies from USA, from Africa, from other countries in the world, and we realize that we don't have enough of creations from Quebec. And also, we wanted to encourage that. So it's for that this program exists also. It's to give the tools to people so that they can create their own project, and people can see projects coming from our own communities here.
Yeah, and why do you think that Is it just, you know, the Afro-Montreal community is like, there's a lot of folks doing a lot of cool stuff. Is it just that there's been this lack of institutional support or money or acceptance? Like, what do you see as the kind of barrier there?
There's a lot of things. There's systemic racism also, and the fact that the institutions, there is many barriers that can stop people from entering those institutions. So it's for that mathematics exists, and it's a lot of things. It's for that I would use the word of systemic racism and systemic homophobia, and that can make it difficult for some people. And even us at mathematics, we kind of see what kind of some people explain what kind of microaggression can stop people from going further, because people are unaware of what pronoun use or they identify, or they can be microaggression about their identity, their cultural identities, about where they come from. So it's for that, yes. It's a mix of things that can make people not be successful and make it more difficult to interact with the mainstream.
Absolutely, yeah. And so for anybody listening, that's going to take place starting this Thursday, going through until Sunday. And it's at the McCord Museum. You can find more details at massimati.ca. Laurent, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
All right, well, take care.
Take care, you too.
Hydro-Québec cherche du monde pour travailler cet été comme guide dans ses centrales et centres d'interprétation partout au Québec. Du monde qui a envie de faire partie d'une équipe énergique qui contribue à changer le monde. Du monde qui souhaite vivre une expérience inoubliable qui ouvre des portes. Tu aimes t'exprimer en public et tu cherches un emploi bien rémunéré? Joins-toi à l'équipe. Postule d'ici le 3 mars au hydroquebec.com/emploi-guide.
All right, you are listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm your host, Jules, and this is a local journalism initiative roundup where we share stories. Typically, we share stories that I've been working on here at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. But today, we also have a piece from our volunteer in the news collective, Gazelle. She went to McGill and talked to a bunch of folks on the AMPL picket line. That's an association, basically. It's a budding union of law profs at McGill, and they want to be treated fairly by McGill. They say that's not happening, and they'll strike, they'll do mass public actions until they are finally recognized by the university. Take a listen.
Since 8:30 this morning, McGill's Law Professors Union has been on strike and picketing outside the faculty in response to the university's behavior during their collective agreement negotiations. I arrived on site around 2 p.m. to speak with the professors about their demands, negotiations, and some other students who were on site in support of the professors.
My name is Victor Muniz-Fraticelli. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Law and in the Department of Political Science. It's been wonderful. We thought, you know, early in the day when there's no class, how are we going to get here, people here voluntarily at 8:30? We had a full picket line at 8:30. It has only grown. We've given them food, we've given them coffee, we've given them cocoa, and they've given us an enormous amount of support. We marched down to the James Building with a big contingent right at noon, had a couple of speeches over there, had a show of solidarity for the rest of the campus, came back, and we've been holding strong, and we'll keep holding strong for the next hour or so until the last shift of classes here in the Faculty of Law. So I've been very, very happy.
The Association of McGill Professors of Law, or AMPL, was certified in 2022 after a year of hearings and litigation with the university. And since it's been certified, the university has been bargaining with them to create their first collective agreement at the same time that it's been litigating against and asking for judicial review of the certification, as well as amendments to who is included in the bargaining unit.
The university has not accepted our existence, even though we've had an overwhelmingly clear decision on the part of the labor board, which has drafted its decision in such a way as to say, look, folks, this is a no-brainer. This falls entirely within our ordinary jurisdiction in our favor. And yet, the university has decided to use public money to challenge this decision. No one has, whom we've consulted on either side of the labor law divide, you know, union side lawyers, management side lawyers, nobody has told us that our decision has even the slightest chance of being overturned on judicial review. And yet, you know, they persist with this because they want to demonstrate to the rest of the university that they won't accept unionization. So
that was Professor Richard Janda, a law professor and member of AMPL. McGill has been litigating against the law faculty union for as long as it started, and it has been asking for judicial review of the decision. McGill's stance basically over the past couple years with the union has been that it's not an appropriate bargaining unit for one faculty to have its own union. It's either all of the professors within McGill or no union at all is their argument. Although the professors proved to the labor tribunal in 2022 that the work that they do is so distinct and different in each faculty that they deserve their own union, and they managed to win the case. Now the education faculty is following suit. They've been asking for unionization, and McGill's been playing the same cards, asking for the same thing, making the same arguments ever since.
We have colleagues from education here. We have colleagues from a colleague from engineering here. People, you know, around the campus are looking at this, and they say, "Well, if the law faculty can do it, maybe we can do it too." The university's message is, "No, they can't." So that's why, you know, we've been brought to this point, because we've had to basically explain to the university that there's a reason for having a union, and that is that the rules then get fixed not by it, but collectively with them.
Since 2022, when they got certified, AMPL has been bargaining with McGill for a collective agreement. They've been meeting very infrequently with Professor Fox Deason, who's the president of the union, saying McGill refuses to give them meeting times and partake in good faith negotiations with them. Recently, what has brought them to the strike has been that the university wants a clause in the contract that allows them to unilaterally change some of the conditions of the workplace if they so desire. Professor Fox Deason's going to explain that a little bit more and better than me.
We have essentially come to an agreement on the substance with respect to leaves and with respect to tenure, but there's a huge issue overhanging those. And McGill wants a caveat to all that. And their caveat to all that is that if they decide, after we sign the collective agreement, that they want to change the terms of those articles, they can do so unilaterally. So, and we're trying to explain that that's just not how a collective agreement works. You have to come back and get our consent, talk to us. But we don't want to be out here on strike. We wanted to come to an agreement. So to, you know, bend over backwards, we told McGill, listen, come to us if you want to change the regulations on this. We'll consider your request. We will not unreasonably withhold our consent to your request. If you think we're being unreasonable, you can take that to an arbitrator. They refused that. We'll even agree to expedited or accelerated arbitration that would get them to see an arbitrator within a few days, so they wouldn't be held up. They refused that and said, and if you win at arbitration, we'll pay for all the costs. And they still would not accept it. So if I had to say what was the last straw, it was us sort of realizing that, you know, we've been negotiating for a year. We could negotiate for another year and come to agreement on substantive terms. But if the status of those terms is that McGill can change them at its sole discretion, then it's not a collective agreement. It's, you know, it's a kind of faux collective agreement or something. It's a collective agreement in name only, and we want a real collective agreement. So we're not even out here on strike for money right now. We're just out here on strike to to get a collective agreement, which they are, in principle, it seems, opposed to. And part of that opposition, too, is denying us days to meet with them. So they've refused to meet with us now until the next date they've agreed to is March 22nd. Right, over a month away.
You know, we've been brought to this point because we've had to basically explain to the university that you know, there's a reason for having a union, and that is that the rules then get fixed not by it but collectively with them. I think I can say this, that we were surprised to discover that the university questioned, you know, whether you would even put into a collective agreement the working conditions that govern professors, that they were saying that if we were to put that into the collective agreement, that would mean that it would be difficult to change. You know, that it would be hard for the university to change those terms and conditions if they were in a collective agreement. And we said, exactly. That's the point of the collective agreement. That's why we have it. So either they don't understand the basic principles, or in fact, this is just a matter of dragging things out that we're forced to talk about even the most obvious features of collective bargaining.
We've told McGill if we don't have a collective agreement in principle by August 15th, we're going on strike. Now it'll be going on strike again, and it would certainly be for more than a day.
A lot of resources pushing back against the professors' union for no real reason, and I think it's a bit of an interesting move to try and go against our law professors, who are all Supreme Court clerks and lawyers themselves, and they all know their rights. So pretty interesting tactics from our dean and McGill.
A bit cocky, a bit delusional, one might say.
A bit delulu, that's for sure. Our dean actually crossed the picket line this morning. I'm not sure if anyone's told you that, but that was a really interesting thing for him to do, especially because he is a scholar who talks all the time about constitutional rights, yet doesn't want other people to be exercising their constitutional rights.
And what was that interaction like? Were you there?
Yeah, I was there. I watched him cross the picket line, and I also saw him indoors when we were going through the building, and he basically told us, you shouldn't be here, and then sent a bunch of security out. So it was very hostile and didn't really align with the wider approach that he says we have at McGill Law.
Lines. When Leckie got up to the Board of Governors in the James, he said, I'm Robert Leckie, the Dean of Law of Fame. You're just the man, said Bertrand, don't let law profs make a fuss, or else we'll have a union all across campus. Dean Leckie, fighting back the union. Dean Leckie, appealing the tat. Dean Leckie, makes a mighty scarecrow for any other faculty who might try that. Well, the others got together and they said this wasn't fair for Dean Leckie to go, a union crushing everywhere. And so they held a vote, a bigger union to create, and the board fired Leckie out the Roddick gates. Dean Leckie went on unemployment. Bob Leckie, the government said fine. Bob Leckie, get busy flipping burgers. It's what you get for sticking with management lies.
The upcoming hearings will be in March about the bargaining unit's specifics with the labor tribunal and the judicial review about the certification per McGill's request will take place in December 2024. This is Ghazal Azizi, CKUT 90.3 FM.
TD and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, 5 special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. Don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Ferreira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Discover the full program on festivalnuitafrique.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
All right, you have been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. Oh, wow, sorry. That was the wrong mic that I was speaking into. That's why it was so quiet. I'm sorry about that, folks. But you've been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. We've had stories about policing in Montreal, a new law prof picket line that happened today for the budding union over at McGill, as well as coverage of an upcoming festival for the Afro-queer community happening this weekend. I'm Jules Bichel. Thanks so much for listening.
Experience a captivating fusion of paintings, photography, an immersive virtual reality experience and more. To kick off the exhibit, JAM Arts is presenting the film African Redemption, The Life and Legacy of Marcus Garvey, screening January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Maison de la Culture Côte des Neiges. Then experience When Big Men Talk, the exhibit, from February 3 to 10 at Galerie Lucie Michel, and after that from February 11 to 14 at the UNIA. For tickets, call 438-507-9258 or head to jam-montreal.com and click JAM Arts Center.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce Nubi Ba to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop in Prairie Theater.